The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, episode 463 for Monday, August 26th, 2013.
Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show where you send in questions, tips, and cool stuff found. We share it all. We answer everything. We try to share everything that we know each and every time we get together, which is really tough when you're trying to do that in an hour, except for us, because we don't know a whole lot. Now, here I am in Durham, New Hampshire, Dave Hamilton.
And here in Fairfield, Connecticut, John F. Braun, and then handing the baton back to...
Durham, New Hampshire. Not in the exact same place as Dave, but awfully close. It's Pilot Pete. Thanks for having me back, guys. It's been a while.
Many would say it's nice to have you. Many would say that it's almost our difference in location is almost a rounding error.
There you go.
However, if that error were corrected, you and I would have a big problem.
That would hurt.
Yes, that's right. John, I believe that this show, as many recently have been, is a prime number. 463.
You sure?
Quick.
I believe so. Yeah. I'm looking on Wikipedia and I believe it is prime. So, you know, yeah, I believe it's prime. Right? Am I wrong about that?
I mean,
it is a prime number. It's the sum of seven consecutive primes prior to it. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I kid you not. I crap you negative.
Interesting.
All right. So let's go. Let's get to the show now that I've totally derailed everyone with one simple comment.
I like the
power. That's good. All right. Danny writes, we've got a bunch of tips to share here. So we'll start with Danny's. He says, I've finally found the issue about my the solution to my issue about my automatically hiding dock and wanted to share. We had talked about Danny's issue where his dock would just hide at times that he couldn't quite figure out and come back, and he was having all kinds of trouble. He says the solution came to me after realizing that Command C for copying an item quit working. Checking in system preferences, short keyboard shortcuts, I noticed that Command C was actually paired to the hide dock item. No idea why, but that's what was causing it. So, yeah, very, very interesting. And it's a good tip in that in addition to troubleshooting, you can assign pretty much anything to a lot of these UI interfaces. Assigning Command C to one is, you know, an odd choice, I'll say. But obviously it wasn't what Danny intended, but still. Very, very interesting. If you go in on your Mac to System Preferences, Keyboard Shortcuts, you can see what's there, but you can change them or add them if they are not listed for the item that you find. So.
Oh, and there's a Restore Default button, too, which is nice.
Yeah, that might be what Danny needs.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Yeah. And it's worth mentioning that this setting actually lives in, so if you go to System Preferences, Personal, Dock, that is where this setting normally lives. Of course, I guess you can map to it
and right.
The automatically hide and show the dock, which personally I leave off because, yeah, I find it disconcerting.
Yeah, depending on screen size, I find hiding the dock. I actually stopped hiding the dock on my MacBook Air as soon as I started moving to full screen mode on things, because that hides the dock and solves that problem for me. All right, you want me to just play Graham here as we head into our series of three Safari tips, and then you'll talk about it, John? Is that right?
I have a little bit, Dad, but yes, yeah.
All right, here we go. Graham, take it away.
Hi, John and Dave, and maybe Pilot Pete. It's
indeed.
Kiwi Graham here. Just thought I'd share a little thing that I found in Safari the other day that I wasn't aware was there. I'm looking in Safari 6.0.5 on my MacBook Pro, which is running 10.8.4. When I highlight a piece of text in Safari that is not a hyperlink, but which is a web address, so it has an HTTP type string to it, After highlighting it, I can now right-click on it, and one of the options that comes up is to open that address in a new tab or new window. I don't recall seeing this before, so I just thought that other people might not know it's there either. Hope that's of help. Cheers.
Thanks, Graham. Much appreciated. Mr. Braun?
The only thing I'll add here, so I did look this up because I was curious about this, Dave.
Yeah.
And how... So, of course, you do have a contextual menu available from Safari, and actually I will paste this in our chat room here. You can actually learn a bit more about this when this applies, and that Apple does have, I believe it's still a distinct, and I believe it's a free program, is that you can join the Safari Developer Program.
That's right.
And if you dig in, and you'll see I pasted the link here, but they have an whole article here about contextual menus within Safari. And it not only applies to when you hover over a URL or a hyperlink, but actually you will see different contextual menus when you are in the toolbar, the bookmarks bar, what they call an extension bar, the tab bar, or the contents of a web page. So they go into a bit more detail here. Now, unfortunately, my goal was to see, you know, is there a way for one to fiddle with this? And as far as I can tell with the latest version of Safari, that is, I did find some utilities that are no longer available or working that would let you modify those settings. I think right now, pretty much the accepted method, though, of extending the functionality of Safari is Safari extensions.
Yeah, that's probably right. Yeah. In fact, I'm sure that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. So this functionality is actually buried in the application itself. And there's
right,
a few others actually. And
right.
Actually, there's and that there's no way for the user to really control this, is that what you get is what you get. But yeah,
right,
certainly depending on the type of content that you highlight. If you haven't looked at the contextual menu in Safari, check it out, because you can do all sorts of things. You can save contents directly to disk if it thinks it's appropriate for you to do that.
Right.
So.
Right. Yeah. No, it's cool that even if it's not, I mean, like Graham pointed out, if it's not a link, Safari is still smart enough to say, hey, this looks like it could be, so let's go open it in a new window and see what happens. Yeah, that's good. All right, moving on to James, because James has yet another Safari tip, probably one, in fact, certainly one that we've covered before, but it's probably been a while. He says, I started having problems with Safari loading websites very slowly or not at all. I tried various things, including a system reboot, but nothing I tried fixed the problem. I finally remembered a tip I heard long ago about Safari's reset Safari option. I used this option, and now websites are loading like they should have. The reset Safari option is one of the options displayed when you click Safari in the menu bar. And indeed, yeah, it will reset a lot of Safari's caches, and that can really, really help. You can, in fact, you get to pick what you want it to reset nowadays, and that can, it can, I've seen it help too. I'm trying to remember, I guess that's where we do caches in Safari now. There used to be an empty caches option in Safari, but now it's just this with reset Safari, and you get to pick what you're doing and what you're not doing. So good stuff. Anything on that, John?
Absolutely.
Go.
Of course.
Good.
So I believe this is a compliment to this, Dave, but if you are noticing issues with your browser, the other place to look is to take one of our favorite utilities, Onyx, and they do have a subset of functions here. So if you go into Onyx and you go to cleaning, there is an internet category, and it has a whole bunch of good stuff here. And I think some of it is redundant, but some is not. In that you can clear out the DNS cache, the browser cache, download cache, like you were saying, Dave, a lot of these caches, browser history, recent searches, and so on. So you can get Onyx and look at this here, but it's a feature built into Onyx. So I think Onyx will do a little bit more than this reset Safari thing, and that it does more general stuff, not just Safari. But it's worth looking here if you are having issues with your browser.
Cool. I also did find, John, that the empty caches option did not go away entirely. It did move out of the Safari menu. I believe that happened with Mountain Lion. But if you have enabled Safari's develop menu, which you do in Safari's Preferences Advanced, you check the little show develop menu in menu bar option. If you have enabled that in the develop menu, you will find empty caches and also disable caches, which is probably not something you'd want to do on a regular basis. But there it is. So, yes, you can just empty the caches, which also I've found can solve some really pesky Safari issues. And as a bonus tip, John, perhaps a bonus tip on top of the bonus tip. Well, I wanted to know. I thought, well, this is weird because I could have sworn I'd done empty caches in Safari since Mountain Lion because it's been out for a while. And I thought, you know, it's got to be somewhere. And I sort of glanced through the menus and I couldn't find it. So with Safari up, I went to the help menu. And then at the very top of the help menu, you get a search option. And I typed in cache, C-A-C-H-E. And it shows me two menu items at the top of that search result. And when you float over either one of them, it actually opens the menu and points at what you're looking for. So if you're in an app that has a lot of menus or a lot of things buried in menus, then you're looking for an option you cannot find. This is the way to find it. Handy, huh, John?
Fantastic.
That's what we do. All right. Scott has an interesting take on Safari. Well, it's a tip, isn't it?
Hey, John and Dave. This is Scott in D.C. I have a quick tip for you. I found this first on my iPad, but this also works on the iPhone. You know, you keep clicking through emails and you open up web pages. Well, the iPhone limits you to 8 web pages, and it's a little easier to close the pages because the buttons are a little bigger. But if you have large fingers like I do, sometimes it's difficult to press on those little X's on the tab on the iPad. So what you do is you go into System Preferences, and you go to the Safari, down to the Safari menu, and you go to the section there that says Turn On Private Browsing. And then once you do that and you switch on private browsing, which, you know, a lot of people call porn mode, but, you know, it is private browsing. But I'll get to that in a second. You turn on private browsing, and the first thing that will pop up is say, close all tabs, and you press the button that says close all, and it closes all the tabs. So if you have a lot of tabs open, and you don't want to go through and try to poke at the little X for each individual one, just turn private browsing off and then on again. On and then off again, and you'll get the dialogue twice, but that's okay. At least that button's a little easier to press than all those little X's. And oh, by the way, when you do private browsing turns on the DNT header option, which is the Do Not Track option for websites, for those that actually follow it, and they should be, and also does not save any history or any cookies, even what is supposed to be disk-based persistent cookies. It could be a pain for sites you log into all the time. You may want to live with that. That's it. I hope this helps somebody, and have fun and have a nice day. Don't get caught.
Thanks, Scott. That's awesome. I see we got the bonus tip built into that one. With the Do Not Track header. That's great. I like it.
That is a good one. I saw something recently online that just made me chuckle, but it was a Medi Alert bracelet, and what it said on it was, delete my browsing history.
That's so awesome.
If found, that's delete perfect. My browsing history.
That's good.
Because not only is Scott implied that, you know, certain adult content, you may not want people to see that you've been looking at that, but that there's certainly other content that you don't want in your history to
absolutely
give people breadcrumbs to find out, you know, personal information.
Yeah. So, I mean, it sort of fits in. It's like, in a very, very light way, sort of as a tack on to our conversation about, you know, Tor browsing and all of that stuff. I mean, this is not that, but at least this keeps what you've done from leaving any crumbs behind on your computer. Other computers that you visited may know you were there, but that's a whole different thing, right? You know, it's private on one side, I guess, is the important thing to remember with private browsing. The websites that you visited still get your IP address. And if you sign up and put your name in, well, then they know that too. So, yeah, it's good. All right, John, before, so I want to have, there's a discussion that, frankly, that I've been avoiding Because it's very difficult to talk about, I think. Not that I have.
And now that I'm here, you're willing to have it?
What's I don't know. That's right. Yeah, that's
yes,
right.
Pete.
Thank you, Pete. And it's about secure email. I think it's great. We should talk about it. It's just some of the nitty gritty gets very difficult to teach audibly. But I think we're going to be able to solve that. First, though, I want to talk about our first sponsor for this show, which is Connected Data and the Transporter. Now, you've heard us talk about it. Longtime listeners have heard us talk about the Transporter before. New listeners, the Transporter is by far the easiest way to get set up with private cloud. And by private cloud, I mean you want to have data that is stored in the cloud, accessible from anywhere, but you don't, being private, you don't want it stored on someone else's servers where potentially they could access your data. So with private cloud, you're storing it on your own server. And the Transporter from Connected Data, which is now becoming part of Drobo, I believe, the Transporter is that server. Out of the box, it is a private cloud server. You install it, or you pull it out of the box, you plug it into your network, and install the software, and away you go. And you get this syncing ability where you put stuff in a folder on your Mac, and that folder is synced up to the Transporter. You can access it whether you're on your local network or on a network from afar, and you can also give friends or family members access to your Transporter and specific folders on your Transporter if you choose to do so, coworkers as well. And you can then, you can then have two Transporters that sync up with one another. And so that's the gist of this. The great news is that they have just revved their software, and Transporter version 2.0 is out for those that want it. It is in what they're calling early access, and they've got a blog post about it. They're taking a phased approach to rolling this software out and upgrading the install base and kind of rolling new people in every 72 hours or so. If you want to fast track yourself on this because you already have a Transporter, you can do so by logging in at the normal management website, secure.connecteddata.com, and you can download the installer right there. So you don't have to wait to get the invitation. They wanted us to tell you if you are interested in having it right away. And trust me, you're going to want this if you've got a Transporter. You can get it right away. All new Transporters, if you were to order one today and get it shipped to you, they all come with 2.0 out of the box. So you're okay there. 2.0 is the interface is so much simpler. As I said, it just uses a folder. There's no real weird file system thing happening on your Mac. They've worked a lot on the connectivity so that you can access it better when you're at on weird networks remotely and that sort of thing. But really the big increase is this standard folder structure that's stored on your Mac. So Time Machine can back it up. It works like Dropbox now. So if you move a file in, it's not in both places. It's not in its original location and also in your Transporter folder. It's only there. It makes a whole lot more sense now for the general user. And I think that's really important. Again, this is the simplest way to get private cloud. And I encourage you to check it out. You can go to filetransporter.com. I believe it's filetransporter.com/MGG. And that will bring you to their website, and it lets them know that we sent you. When you buy from them, though, and this is where it gets really important, if you use the coupon code MacGeekGab, you get 10% off, which can actually save you quite a bit. With a 1 terabyte drive, the Transporter is $299. With a 2 terabyte drive, it's just $100 more, $399. Or you can get it with no drive. If you have your own 2.5-inch drive to put in, you can get it for $199. Any of those options bought directly from Transporter with the coupon code MacGeekGab gets you 10% off. So if you're buying a two terabyte Transporter, you're saving almost $40. So that's worth doing. Check it out. Filetransporter.com/MGG and let us know what you think. We very much appreciate it. All right, John, with that in mind, I did promise that we were going to try this conversation. And one thing happened this week. I actually did a conversation about microphones with Allison Sheridan, which went up today. So that's part of her Nozilla cast. And we'll put a link in to the show notes for that. And afterwards, we started talking about, she asked me, and so many people, Pilot Pete, kind of, you know, without being prompted, asked me about email security. She asked me about email security. John, you and I have been talking about it sort of behind the scenes for a month now, right?
Why could this be?
Well, yeah, I actually, you know, I created some new certs before this NSA thing happened. But I'm sure glad that, you know, that I did and I got it all sorted out. But you know, the issue was, we're going to talk about what this is and how to do it, but a lot of the nitty gritty gets too nitty gritty for us to explain to you and expect you to remember. So Allison does have a way to help us with that. And with that, I'm going to let her, she'll explain and then we'll dive in.
Hi, John and Dave. Allison Sheridan of the NozillaCast podcast here. Back in March on episode 412 of my show, Bart Buschatz walked us through how to set up sign-in encrypted email on Mail.app on the Mac and also on iOS. He gave us this in a, you know, verbal way because it's a verbal podcast. And after we got off the air, I sat down and walked through step by step what Bart had taught me, with his help coming in and out on Skype to help me make sure I did it right, and created a set of tutorials to actually walk people step by step through how to do this. I thought you guys might like this. I've put a link in the email here that will show you three separate tutorials. One, how to set up encrypted and signed email in Apple Mail. The second one, how to export your certificate and private key. And then the third and final step, how to read encrypted and signed emails on iOS. I hope you guys like it. Talk to you again soon.
Thanks so much, Allison. This is the key that we were looking for here. And we'll also, did you like that, John? But I will look to, I'm glad that you're here, Pete, A, yeah, because you asked about it, but B, because you're here to kind of make sure we're explaining this and not going too fast. But I'm also going to look to, and say hello to everybody in the chat room at macgeekgab.com/stream to do the same thing here on this, this Monday afternoon. So the general gist, we're going to do this in a way that we hope makes sense to you. The general gist is, you can, and Allison has given us instructions here that we can direct you to and will direct you to, but you can create your own secure keys, and we'll explain what all this is in a minute, but you go and create your own secure keys, you install them into your Mac's keychain, and then magically OS X Mail will show you two new buttons on every email that you send. One is a little check mark or an X if it's off that allows you to sign that email and say, you know, with a very distinct way, you can say this email came from me. And then the other allows you to encrypt the email if, in fact, you're synced up with the person that you're sending it to by having them sign an email to you so that you have their key to encrypt it with. And it really is, once it's installed, it is that simple. You just launch Mail, you don't have to do anything else, and you get the ability to sign your emails. And if you have exchange signatures with somebody else, then you can encrypt emails to that person. And it's brilliant. That's using a piece of technology called S/MIME, S/MIME. That's what's built into Mail. There is also a way to use PGP and really open PGP with a set of utilities called GPG tools, which is available for free to download. GPG tools actually uses the same functionality inside Mail. It uses the same buttons even, so that you have a similar interface, but it's using just a different set of encryption standards. The problem with GPG Mail is twofold. Number one, both people have to manually install it on both ends. So not only do you have to create your keys, but you have to install some software, but it's free. And number two, the first method, because it's built into Apple Mail, is also built into iOS Mail. So you can send and receive encrypted emails and signed emails right there from your iPhone inside the Mail client. With GPG, you need a third-party app. So these are two ways, and it really is as simple as I've explained once you've installed it. You set up a new message, and right there in the right there in the header section, you get little checkboxes or buttons, rather, I guess, John, is the right way to say it, right? That you can turn on or off. And it works. And you and I have been doing it for quite a while now, in fact. And it works great. Yes?
We have.
Yes.
I want to clarify, just to add a little bit here, which I think is still on the application side, because my problem, I think, unfortunately, understanding the bits and bytes and the technology here, one quickly dives into the terminology and then people get lost. And we want to really try to avoid that.
We're going to get to the terminology and get to not so much of the terminology, but some of the underlying structure of what you're doing when you're encrypting and signing an email and what that actually means. Right. But I want you to know that once you install this, and it really isn't that bad to install, but there's a couple of hoops you got to jump through. Once you install it, it is super easy to do on both your Mac and iOS. So go ahead, John.
I want to separate because in the past we have talked about this when we've been talking about email and how to set it up.
Yep.
So I just want to differentiate what we're going to talk about with what we've talked about in the past is when you set up mail. And you set up your account and the ports and the servers and stuff like that. One thing that you can do in Apple Mail is to say, please use this thing called SSL to secure my mail. And what that's doing is different from what you and I are going to talk about. That is securing the email going from your computer to an email server. And that's equally important.
Yes.
But it's not a full solution, but it's better than nothing.
It's good because your password is not being sent in the clear. I think that's the most important part of that, right? Is that you're not sending your email password in the clear when you're doing this encrypted tunnel. There's more to it than that, but that's
right.
But yeah.
But also when the email is going from your computer to at least to or from the email server, if you enable this thing called SSL, it will protect what's happening between you and the email server.
Right.
So that's a good first step. But what you and I are going to talk about now actually protects the contents.
Yeah, you said it. You encapsulated it great in our pre-show, John. You said with SSL or TLS enabled in your mail client, you get to secure the connection. And with what we're going to talk about here, you secure the payload. So it totally because and where that's important is if I send you an email, John, I'm sending it to my mail server encrypted. Great. You're receiving it from your mail server encrypted. Great. So it's been encrypted everywhere that it's been sort of in the wild, but it's now sitting on both my computer and your computer, one in my sent folder, two in your received folder, in unencrypted form.
And on the server.
On the server in unencrypted form.
While it's sitting there, yes.
Well, if you have IMAP mail, it's sitting on the server potentially forever.
Right.
And after 6 months, it's public domain.
That's right. And that's actually really important, Pete.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead and mention that.
Yeah. Well, after I forget the exact name of the law, but essentially email that sits on the server for longer than 6 months, by law is considered abandoned. And simply no warrant, no nothing, simply a letter from law enforcement saying, you know what, Dave Hamilton's email account is of interest to us in an investigation we're conducting. Please forward all emails older than 180 days to us. And every email, I know you go back years on your Gmail.
Yeah, I do.
Every email for years and years and years gets dumped right to law enforcement. No warrant, no...
I have no idea that this has happened.
Oh.
Potentially.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly. And there's no need to inform you. You don't matter.
That's up to my provider.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And I'm certain, in my heart, I have no evidence of this, but I'm certain that Google and Yahoo and MSN and all those people are complying with requests like this on a daily basis.
I'm sure they are.
Sure.
And if you want to see this, and then I'll hand it back to you here, Dave. But if you want to see this, and this actually, I did this just to give myself a warm fuzzy that this encrypted email stuff works.
Yeah.
If you go to your home folder, library, mail, V2. Now, we've touched on this before, but I want to touch on it again because it's relevant to this conversation, I think. If you go into that folder and you dig a little deeper, and then you're going to see folders that are specific to your... each of your email accounts.
Yeah.
And then there's going to be an mBox folder. But if you keep digging, eventually you're going to get to the point where you're going to see the raw email messages. I think it's an EMLX file.
That's right. No, that's exactly right. Yeah.
But if you look at that file, and this is how this may, you know, shock some people here, but, you know, it's good, I think. But if you look at, and actually here, I'm digging in, you got to dig in, but it's EMLX. EMLX is the raw email file. If you click on that, you're going to see the email in all its plain, unencrypted, anybody can read it glory.
Yeah, so the reason Apple standardized on these EMLX files is because it Spotlight works really well when it can index individual files. So having mbox files where all the emails are stored kind of in one encapsulated in one file, not as easy for Spotlight to search. So they move to this. But either way, even an mbox file, it's just stored in plain text. That's what Eudora used. I mean, these are standards that are published out there, and it's not unique to Apple.
Go ahead. Now, I don't want to go on too much of a tangent here. You just brought up in a very important point here, and I'm not sure what the answer is. I think I know what it is, but encrypted emails, I don't believe, are going to be indexed by Spotlight.
No, I don't think
okay.
so.
That's something we'd have to test. Only reason I have hesitation there is because with these SMIME emails, which is the kind that Allison's tutorial points us to setting up the kind that's built in by default to mail on at your Mac and iOS. If it's built in by default, perhaps Spotlight is able to, it does index them. We're going to have to try it. So what we're going to do, John, is we'll send each other an email with a very, with a phrase that doesn't exist anywhere else. And then we search for it, right? That's the real trick. So I'm going to send you this email while we're talking about this, and I'm going to encrypt it.
Supercalifragilistic.
Let's see. So test email, and then inside the email, I am going to put the phrase. How come it won't secure it? There it is. Okay. So I am going to put, MacGeekGab, no spaces, is live now, come and get it. So I will paste that into the chat room too. and I'm sending you this email. So once you get it, then you can search with Spotlight. And certainly by the end of this conversation, we'll have an answer there. So it is great. Sending this email. It should be on its way to you now. So, okay. While we're investigating that particular little fun thing, the way this works is, we've talked about with other things and with this, when we talked about it the first time a couple of years ago, is using key pairs. And we don't want to get too deep here, but we want to make sure you understand what it is that's happening. And please, we'll follow this up with a discussion in a future show. Please correct us if we get anything that you feel is wrong, because I want to make sure our listeners get this right. When you set up your keys, you're actually creating two keys. One is public and one is private. And what happens is, in fact, what just happened when I sent you this email, John, is you had shared with me your public key. And the best part is you can share that with anybody you want. And again, with mail, this happens automatically when John signs a message. It comes along with his public key, and Safari and mail is smart enough to say, hey, go ahead and store that in the keychain in case we need it in the future. But there is no problem with me having John's public key, because all I can do with John's public key is encrypt messages. I can't even decrypt messages that I have encrypted with John's public key. But what you have, John, is you also have, hopefully, otherwise this test won't work. Hopefully you still have your private key, and your private key, when combined with your public key, allows you to decrypt any messages sent encrypted with your public key. So it's totally fine to share your public key with the world. And it's why I could have an email, like I have Pete's public key and I have John's public key. I could actually send a message to both of you. And I should have with that one. Yeah. And it would have let me encrypt the message for each of you simultaneously.
And we get two separate messages.
I'm not sure about that.
I wonder how that works.
Let's do a test. So let's send to John and Pete.
It would have to.
It would have to, because I couldn't decrypt
it. I think it would be.
Knows to encrypt two different.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, no, it won't. Oh, do I not have your public key on this? I might not have your public key on this. Oh, I don't have an SMIME key for you, Pete, because you don't have
you're
one.
Right.
That's why. Okay.
That's going to change soon.
I don't think it I don't think it sends two messages. It might send one email that has two separate. I don't know, John. I'm pretty sure that it will create one encrypted block that is decryptable by both of you.
Interesting.
I'm pretty sure that's not how it works, because the way you described it. So the way to think of it is that this whole thing this is something called public key encryption.
Right.
And the nice thing about it, it's almost like, think about the whole nuclear bomb launch thing, is that you need two pieces to get anything done. Having one or the other of these keys, one we'll call the public key and one the private key, you can't accomplish whatever tasks you're trying to accomplish with only one of them. You need both.
Mm.
And encrypting uses one to do one part and the other to do the other part. And signing is kind of the reverse. But you need both of them. And the whole part of it is that, and the thing to me that's important, I don't want to deviate too much here, but no, I think it's important here. So when you generate these keys, Dave, the important part here is this thing called the private key, which is you.
Yes.
When you generate a private key, there is Dave Hamilton's private key. There is John Braun's. There is Pete's private key. You have to make sure that you do not lose that, because if you lose one or the other of these keys, now the thing is, the public key by nature is something you can release to the public, but if you ever lose your private key, you are in deep trouble.
Oh, absolutely.
You've just lost the one piece of the puzzle that you need to unlock.
Let's get to the question though, because I'm pretty sure, and I just pulled out, I have the email that was sent to both you and me. And it is one email. My mail client sent one email out with one SMIME attachment to it that both of us are able to decrypt. So it is an attachment that has probably the same message encrypted twice, I would assume, but I might be wrong about that. But it is one message that both of us are able to decrypt. And if you were to forward what you got back to me, I could decrypt it.
Interesting.
Yes.
I don't get my head around that, but it doesn't matter. I mean, that's really down into the.
Yeah.
You know, it may be one attachment. It may be one attachment that has one piece that's appropriate for me and one.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. So it is one email. Okay. So we've got these key pairs and that's how this works. SMIME, which is the technology that's built in to mail on your Mac and iOS, does it that way. To get a key pair with SMIME, though, you need to go through, you'll want to, most likely, go through a certificate authority. You can create your own key pair, but if you do, mail on the recipient's end will indicate that it has no way of proving you are who you are, and will notify the user of this. You can, if you know what you're doing, go in and say, that's okay, I want to trust them anyway. But in order to get a key that is just universally trusted, you need to go through some service that effectively verifies that you have the email address that you say you do. And so what happens is you go to one of these services and you enter in your name and your email address and you say, I want a public key. And then it's actually very interesting, and I've learned a lot more about this. Your browser generates the key pair and then sends through the certificate request, all sort of in the background. And then you'll get an email saying, okay, your certificate's ready to pick up as long as you click the link in this email. And that's their way of confirming that you have the email that you say you have. And then you click it and it goes and downloads the rest of this certificate, packages it all together in your keychain, and you're good to go. And then mail will work when you're sending email out. And then that's how that works. If there are many ways to get these, there are two that I know of that allow you to do it for free. Start SSL allows you to do non-commercial certificates for free. And we'll put that link in the show notes, of course. And Komodo, Comodo, has a free email certificate. And I'm not even sure that that's commercial, that's personal only. That may also be valid for commercial use. So we'll put both of those in the show notes for you, though. So you can just go to one of these places. Probably want to follow the tutorial that we've listed from Allison, and you can create your SMIME keys and off you go. And that's going to work with the default stuff in mail.
And the reason that it works, so part of this, you know, be careful in here. But if you go to Keychain Access, which is the utility that Apple offers you, that for the most part is the place where all their certificates are stored.
Yep.
The reason that this works and that mail does not yell at you is because these guys, the guys who issue these certificates, including Komodo and Start SSL and all that, they have submitted their public key to Apple. And you can see them, Dave, if you go into Keychain Access and you go into the system roots part of Keychain Access, you're going to see a big, long list of all these people that are called CAs or certificate authorities. And guess what? You're going to see Komodo in there. And if I look more, I'm going to see Start SSL, or I better.
Yeah, or whomever they use. They may rely on someone else's authority and do this chain of authority, which is totally fine. Yep.
Right. What's going to happen if they're not in there, then what's going to happen, and as Dave said, what you're going to see is when you receive an email that's properly encrypted and signed, and actually that's the other part of it. I don't know if you mentioned it, but when you receive an email, and this is, again, kind of a cool hidden feature in mail, is that you're going to see in the mail header a little thing saying, oh, this is encrypted and this is signed.
Yep.
And if it's not encrypted, and now if it's not signed or encrypted by someone who is in this
circle of trust
part,
yeah,
then it's going to yell at you. Then mail may say, oh, all right, well, it's signed or encrypted, but I'm not sure if I trust it. And you can override that, and you probably don't want to.
Well, no, actually, there's nothing wrong with that, because we're about to talk about GPG tools where you're
right.
doing that all the time. That is the MO. That's the only way to do it. So, yeah, if I choose to create my own email certificate, which you can do with Keychain Access right there on your Mac, you just go to Certificate Assistant, say create a certificate. You say I want to do it for email, and it will do it. But it will come across as self-signed. But you can then go in and say, that's OK. I want to approve this. There's nothing wrong with that. It just doesn't work well for the majority of the world because they're all seeing it as though it's an unsigned certificate. Yeah.
So the advantage of using these S/MIME certificates and using someone like Komodo or Start SSL is that the mechanism to say that they're legitimate is built in to the keychain and built into the OS.
So folks in the chat room and Pilot Pete, are we doing okay here? Have we lost you?
Yeah, no.
Okay. All right.
Still grokking it.
Okay. All right, good. So this is the sort of the general technology. This is, we've talked about S/MIME and how it works in OS X Mail. I mentioned, John, that we have this other thing called GPG Mail, which uses another open source standard, if you will, called PGP, pretty good privacy, and GPG is GPG tools is an all-in-one suite based on the open source version of PGP, which is OpenPGP, and integrates really well with your Mac. It's the version 2 is new. It's only about a month old, but it looks great. And what's cool is when you install it, it defaults to use OpenPGP, but you can actually right there on your Mac bounce back and forth and choose if you want to do S/MIME or OpenPGP. And if I were to choose to send email to somebody that I have one type of certificate for, but not the other, it actually intelligently bounces back and forth. Which is cool. And again, it works the same way, except that you don't go to some website to create your certificate. You go inside the GPG Keychain Access application, which is a new app installed with GPG tools. And you click on, you click on create, it'll actually prompt you to create your own key, and you create your own key. And then you can either leave it stored locally only, public and private. Thank you, John. Right. And you can leave them stored locally only, or you can choose to upload your public key to a public key server so that if someone's looking to send email to you, they can find that key, which is really handy. So we have actually uploaded Mac Geekab keys. We've created both sets for Mac Geekab. And if we sign a message to you, you can send back encrypted to us if you choose. But you can also find GPG or PGP keys out in the all the repositories. They're out there for both feedback at MacGeekGab.com and premium at MacGeekGab.com. It's actually one key for both, because with GPG, you can have multiple email addresses on the same key. With SMIME, not quite as easy. So where do we go from here, John?
At least the way that I have it set up here, Dave, mm-hmm. I think the one difference to the user is that if you're doing a PGP or GPG, if you're using that mechanism, initially what's going to happen is that if you get an encrypted and signed email, or you may just get a signed email or just an encrypted, though usually people like to use both because, sure, I mean, they complement each other. One scrambles the contents and the other provides identity and also pretty much tells you that the email has not been tampered with, is what a signing operation does. But the thing is, the PGP model relies on you. So rather than what's in your keychain, it relies on you to define the trust level for each of these certs that you get, or at least that's what I saw when I installed it, Dave.
I agree with that. Yeah.
So what happens is that, so if I get a PGP encrypted or open PGP email from Dave, and I double click on the sign on the icon in mail that says signed by Dave Hamilton, initially it's going to come up and say, this is not trusted. Now, of course, I trust Dave with my life. But of course I trust Dave.
Right.
But it says that because their model, rather than involving these guys called CAs, they kind of leave the responsibility to you as the user. So they kind of make you a system administrator, and that you're going to say, so if I pull in your public key into my keychain, into my PGP keychain, initially it's going to be listed as a trust level unknown, and that I don't know who this is. So I have to actually go to it and actually say, okay, let me define the level of trust for this key that I downloaded from the public key server. And once I do that, then when you double click on it in mail, and sometimes you got to shut everything down and start it up again. Sometimes it lags a bit. That's the one thing I found that was kind of annoying.
Yep.
Then it'll come up. So if I then say, oh, okay, well, Dave Hamilton, yeah, I trust him. And I go into the GPG keychain utility and say trust level is something other than unknown. Then when I double click on in mail, it'll come up and say, yeah, you can trust him. So
you sign other guys, each other's keys.
Yeah.
Right. It involves rather than automating the process in that, oh, well, if you went to this, you know, company that has a certificate in the Apple keychain, it's trusted. Here, it leaves the user to define the level of trust for things you pull in here.
Yep.
So, underlying technology is the same, is that it's all public key and stuff like that, but
right,
it's leaving more of the responsibility for defining some of this. Not to say that it doesn't work. No, it does
right.
work, but
oh,
it's,
yeah.
it's a different model in that it leaves more of the it leaves it to the user to define the trust
100% of
the identity.
Time. Yeah.
Yes.
That's right. No, that's good. Where was I going to go with this? I had somewhere I wanted to go. It was good too. It was
well,
good.
I'll go somewhere else here, Dave.
All right, go ahead.
Now here's perhaps one of the downsides here. So the thing is, as we mentioned, if you dig into your system and you look at the raw email files, as we mentioned, normally you can just double click on this ELMX file.
Yep.
And you'll see everything. Now, you know what's going to happen if you double click on one of those files and you're not running the appropriate crypto program, you're going to see a big block of incomprehensible gibberish. And actually, it's probably going to be preceded with something like PGP. I forget the exact wording, but it's actually an attachment, and it's actually preceded by something. I think it's like encrypted PG. I'm trying to remember, but it's suffice to say, you will not be able to read this without the help of running either mail with the SMIME installed properly or the GPG extensions, and that the content on your hard drive, someone cannot take those raw files and read them.
Yes, that's right.
Because that's what I want to make sure of.
That's
and
right.
Likewise, when they're stored on the server, and I saw this. So the other kind of downsides here. So for example, when you and I were playing with this,
yeah,
I could read these emails. So you and I were initially using OS X. Because I think OS X's implementation is better than iOS, where it's a little more straightforward.
Well,
trying to get this stuff to work on iOS is you got to jump through some hoops here. But the thing is,
it actually works system, with S/MIME. Okay. And if you follow the tutorial with S/MIME, it works great on iOS. But with what you have to do in order to make it work on iOS, I'm not going to go into too much detail, but you have to create the key pair on your Mac and get it all there in your keychain and then export it in a format that iOS can read. And this format will have both your public and private key in it, and you will protect that with a password. And then you'll take that to your iPhone. The easiest way is to email it, security in mind. And then you just install it. And once it's installed, it's easy, right? But with GPG, iOS does not work. You will get, like John said, you'll either get a message that looks like gobbledygook, or you'll see something more likely. You'll see something with an attachment, and you need a third party app to do it. There's one that's free, but very limited. It only lets you encrypt or decrypt, I think, 5 messages before you've got to pay. So what's the one you're using, Pete? I think it was
Mailvlope.
No, on iOS.
iOS is IP Gmail.
IP Gmail.
It's $1.99.
There you go. Yeah.
It works.
Yeah. Yeah. That's so there you go. It's clunky, though, to get PGP to work on iOS.
Now, I got one, Dave, so it's a freebie.
Yeah, but that's
they actually
that's the
have
one.
A light version.
That's the problem
Well, OpenGP, it's called.
Yeah, I know that's the one I have. And I just if you use it enough, it will fail on you and tell you have to buy it. And
I got the free version. The problem is the free version. You got to do some manual cut and paste.
No,
there's also
listen to what I'm saying.
I am listening and I have not seen it. Tell me it will not work.
After 5 or maybe 10 messages, OpenGP Lite will tell you have to pay in order to use it. And listen, I'm totally fine with having to pay to use it. But that was a surprise to me, and I do not like surprises when I need to decrypt emails. So I much prefer to pay up front and know that I'm never going to have crippleware. If you're going to go for OpenGP, unless you're just using it to test very lightly. But if you're going to rely on it in any way, shape or form, do not get the light version of OpenGP because it will shut down on you. I think it's only 5 decryptions and it's done, which is not good.
Bummer.
Yeah, it's bad news. It's bad. Shame on them for not making that way too clear.
Well, yeah, no, that wasn't clear to me at all.
Right, that's what I'm saying.
Okay, it's kind of clunky, but it works. You got to manually cut and paste here and there, but
yeah,
yeah. Shame on them.
Yep.
Now to get back to what we were talking about here, the thing is, when the stuff is stored on the email server, whether it be POP or it doesn't really matter. The bad news is if you don't have a utility, then it's going to look like gobbledygook. The thing is, the good news is that the content that's stored on the email server is encrypted.
Right.
And if anybody comes along and grabs it, unless they, work for a 3-letter agency or have your keys, they won't be able to make heads or tails of what's on the server.
And even if they work for a 3-letter agency, they won't have your keys.
Well, I'm making some assumptions here.
Well, yeah, but that's the point of this, right? Yeah. Is to ensure that it's encrypted. A 3-letter agency could, in theory, they could set up a honeypot and create a key of their own that they attach to your email address and then try to convince your nefarious partners to encrypt with that key instead. But you wouldn't be able to decrypt anything sent with that key because you don't have the private key for it and they don't have the private key for the one you created. So there's no 3-letter agency that's going to be able to decrypt this stuff through anything but a brute force attack. And
that'll take a week or two.
That'll take a while. Yeah.
Oh, well, that was my argument in that I know in the past, certain 3-letter agencies have either installed backdoors or influenced the development of crypto algorithms to make it easier for them to do things than other people.
Yes. So,
I would say between the two, you're getting pretty much, an equivalent level of
right.
Protection.
I was going to say the only other downside on having it encrypted on your mail server for IMAP and that sort of thing makes it unsearchable.
It does. There, yeah. So John, to wrap this up, search for that phrase. Did you find it? Because I did not, and I sent the email, and I can't find that phrase.
All right, hold on. What was the
I pasted it in the chat room.
Oh, hold on.
Mac Keycap is live now. Come and get it. No spaces. Yeah, I got nothing.
No. So,
okay.
Well, that's probably a good thing that
yeah.
I can't. Now, there may be a Spotlight plugin that would allow this.
That's true. That's totally possible. Oh, yeah.
I suppose it's possible. Now, the only other downside, the only hiccup I ran into today, I was testing it with one of my friends here, and I'm actually working with my ISP. So he tried to send me an encrypted email, and what happened is his mailer, Damon, sent him an email saying remote host reported the following. And it was a Symantec. And I believe Symantec makes software that can run on email servers. And it basically said Symantec antivirus didn't like this attachment because it doesn't know what it is. So it's going to assume it's a virus and reject it.
Fascinating.
And then I got online with my
ISP. It's interesting because Symantec owns PGP now.
Yes, they do.
So
I'm actually working with my ISP and we're kind of getting to a finger pointing thing. Like I called up and they're like, oh, well, call up Apple because, it's through the App Store that the software that your friend is using is from the App Store. So call Apple. And I'm like, yeah, right.
Yeah, right.
Like Apple's going to support that. If anything, the vendor is going to support it. But the only caution here is that some virus scanners may identify these encrypted attachments as something that's funny and'll spit it back. You should get a bounce or a reject or something like that. That's the only hiccup I ran into. And it's only with this one iOS client that my friend is using. So I suspect it's a fault with that and not.
Yeah, it could
hopefully
be.
Not the mechanism
or his mail server.
Everything that you and I have sent to each other has gotten through. So.
Yeah. And Pete started sending me to me too. I mean, you found my key on the repository. And,
yeah. Right on the key server. Yeah. I can't find John's.
John has chosen not to publish his key, and I'm not sure why. Maybe we could ask him.
Well, I'll tell you why.
I'll publish it for you.
I have it.
Who's your buddy?
Well, no. Here's the other issue that with PGP. So the thing is now, Dave, if you search for my name, so one of the features of the GPG suite is that you can search this server that people upload their public keys to. Here's the problem is I've had more than one person come to me and say, hi, John, are you still at jbraun@ct1.nai.net? Which was an email address I had when I used to be with nai.net, which is a ISP when I used to live in Weston. And I don't even think they exist. Actually, if you go to nai.net, it brings you to RCN. So they acquired them at some point, I guess. But the only bad news here, and that's why I'm cautious, is that if you upload a key to a public key server.
Oh, it's there forever.
It's there forever, unless I think you can do something which it gets into some of the terminology, but it's worth talking about, I think, is called revocation. The problem is, if you don't have the private key, which the thing is, yes, it was on my Mac, but I don't think I have a backup of my Mac back from 15 years ago, which is when I think I generated this key, then, well, tough luck. So this gets back to the point I was making is that if you're going to generate a key pair that's yours, make a backup. And back then I have backups.
I have a suggestion because you don't want to store your key pairs on Dropbox, right? Defeating the purpose, handing your private key to someone else, but you could store it.
Not.
You could store it on your transporter, right? And then you can access it from anywhere. Just saying, this is one of those times where private cloud is awesome, and it's not just transporting, any private cloud would work very well for that. I had the same problem as you. I have two keys on the server that I never, in the public key servers that I never use anymore. One of them for jazbo@austintx.net. I was able to revoke that one. I actually found my private key for that in my archives, and that was from like 97. And then in 99, I created a dave@macobserver.com key. And I have no idea where the private key for that is. So that one's still out there. If you want to get me, find the new one. It's dated 2013. So there you go.
So,
and you can set them to expire, which you should do because that way, that way you don't run into this problem. So
the only advice to people is that if you're going to use either of these systems, back up your keychain, especially the private key. But I would say just in general, back up the key or just make backups for goodness sake.
Right. Right. Well, we deal with backups and we deal with data. I know I do. I deal with data way differently than I did back in 1999. I mean,
oh, yeah.
Way absolutely. Differently. You know, I've learned. And hopefully you've learned, too. Okay, so that's enough of that for today.
One last suggestion?
Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, man.
Here's no, go I ahead. Do. No, this is good.
Well, and this is what I'm doing with my key now, because I couldn't find the passphrase to revoke one of my old keys. It's in 1Password.
And oh, that's
hopefully
good.
You'll continue to keep it. So my passphrase for my certificates are now in 1Password, and I can pull them up.
Yeah, great. Right. The storing them somewhere securely.
Right.
That's it.
Right.
Yep. No, that's good. Yeah. That's great. No, thank you for interrupting with that. That's good stuff.
Well, no,
that was good.
One more.
I
one
like
more.
That. But wait, there's less. Okay. Michael writes, listening to your praises of the Apple TV, I thought I would take the plunge and not buy one, but 2 Apple TVs. Before doing so, I would like to know if the following 2 scenarios are possible. Scenario 1, 1 Apple TV is connected to an HD TV in room 1, the second Apple TV to a TV in room 2. Can I set a movie to play on the first Apple TV and have it synchronized with the second Apple TV so that the same movie is playing in the 2 rooms simultaneously? The answer is no, at least not without, you know, calling down downstairs and upstairs and pressing play at the same time and all of that stuff. No, Apple TV does not work that way for video. iTunes, and I believe only iTunes on your Mac, does have the capability of sending audio to multiple devices simultaneously. And that includes an Apple TV. So you can send audio to multiple Apple TVs or like your Airport Express, John, and that'll work, but not video.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I noticed that. I was thrilled. Yeah. I brought up the airport menu that kind of magically appears in iTunes and it's like, oh, well, here's your Express and, oh, do you want to send to your computer too?
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh.
Which is cool. It's great having it in sync. It's like, you know, you're a poor man's Sonos kind of thing. It's good.
I wonder why. I speculate. Now, I think technically it's possible to send an audio video stream to 2 places at once.
Of course it is.
I'm just thinking it may be a hard technical problem because syncing audio and video in and of itself is a hard problem.
Yeah. Yeah.
And sending it to multiple places. So I don't know if it's bandwidth or just, you know, it's not ready for prime time yet. It's too bad.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll see it at some point.
I can't TiVo.
There's other people doing
have
it.
Have you done the multi-room TiVo thing? I know it's available. I only have one destination. Really.
Not with the new TiVo stream. No, I'm still doing it the old way where we just copy stuff back and forth from one TiVo to another. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But I should play with that TiVo stream. That's interesting. And the stream is built into kind of the upper level models of the new TiVo Romeo. So, yeah, that would
Romeo.
Be Romeo. That's right.
That cracks me up because where's Juliet?
That's right. All right. So scenario number 2, Michael asks, is can I display my MacBook screen, Finder, applications, documents, etc. on the TV through the Apple TV? And as in scenario 1, can I connect my MacBook be simultaneously be displayed in room 2? So we already know the answer to number 2. No, you can't, you know, the second part of number 2. No, we can't do video simultaneously in 2 places. However, you can do what's called AirPlay, where you can show your MacBook screen on your TV. You can do it one of 2 ways. You can mirror to it, or you can treat it like a separate display for video only. And you can do the same thing with your iPhone or iPad, as long as it's got a dual core processor. So iPhone 4S or later, iPad 2 or later, which includes the iPad mini and iPod Touch 5. All of those are capable of doing this. And it's so cool. It's one of the best things about having an Apple TV is being able to, you know, pop stuff up and just, you know, it doesn't matter what device you have in your hand, as long as it's Apple's. And you can, you know, you get, it's so cool. So yeah, absolutely. You can do that. You can set mirroring on or not. And oftentimes on my iPhone, say I'll set mirroring off, but I'll set it to display on the Apple TV. And what that accomplishes is I can go on YouTube and find the video that I want to play, and my Apple TV remains, you know, blank or showing the screen flow of pictures from our vacation or whatever that it does on its, you know, its screensaver. And then as soon as I hit play, it doesn't display it on my iPhone. It displays it in all its glory up on the Apple TV. And it's cool. It's fun. We wind up doing a lot of stuff that way. It's great if you've taken a video. You know, we went to Maker Faire. We went to a mini Maker Faire this weekend here in Dover. John, and I took a bunch of videos.
Maker?
Oh, they're cool.
Maker?
Maker Faire. So Make Magazine, years ago, started this Maker Faire thing in California. I think in the Bay Area, it might have been down in San Diego, but anyway. And it really is for people that are just creating stuff, you know, inventing.
Okay, so it's a publication called Maker? Is that it? Or a magazine called Maker?
Make Magazine, which has been around forever. But the fair is called Maker Faire, and it's just where people can come and show crazy stuff that they've done. And it was so popular out there that they've commissioned a bunch of what they call mini Maker Faires. And we had one in Dover. It was huge. Okay. We spent like 3 hours there. I mean, it's stuff all over the map. But, you know, the cool stuff was like, I mean, there was a company there that trains people how to like pick locks. And I learned how to pick a lock, which I'd never done before. So
I saw that. I saw you post a picture of that.
Yeah.
A five tumbler, right?
I did. I started with a one tumbler and I got up to a five. I couldn't get the six.
Have you picked the lock in your house yet or
no, but I know exactly what to do. It's way easier than I ever thought. No. And there was this one woman that showed up and she's like, oh, you have the real tools. She says, I always make my own. And everybody there was like, you know, heads whipped, like what? And it's like this, you know, kind of frumpy housewife looking person. And she's like, yeah, I'm constantly locking myself out of the house. And so, you know, I just use like a hairpin or whatever to pick my locks. And the guys are like, whoa, you know, they're like bowing to her. And she's like, but these are real tools. These would be great to have.
I'm hoping the cops weren't like scoping
But
I think in many states, having lock picks is considered naughty.
Oh, is that right? You can buy them on Amazon.
I think unless you're a licensed locksmith, those could be considered.
Okay, gosh.
Somebody better buy them for me quick on Amazon then. So get them off my wish list. But there was also a guy there. It was awesome. And I know I'm tangentializing here, but, he had a toaster that he'd put a circuit inside it that played the Jack in the Box song, you know, Hop Goes the Weasel, and it would play this. And when it finished the song, the toast would pop out, and it was and he caught it as it popped out. And I was like, dude, that's awesome. Like, you know, this is great. And he says, yeah, it's funny. He says, I had to put the music in because my initial goal was not to make it play music. He said, I changed the spring so that it would shoot the toast way out and I wanted to be able to catch it. He said, but as soon as I did that, it worked. I could catch it, but I had no idea when the toast was coming. So I had to put the music in so that I would know when the toast was coming out.
Funny.
Yeah, it was awesome. So there was tons of stuff like that. Just people making crazy things. So anyway, we got home from the Maker Faire and had some videos on my iPhone that I'd taken of some of these crazy people. And we just were able to sit on the couch and run through them and play them. And so yes, that's to bring it all back home. That's where the Apple TV stuff goes. It's good. It's good. It's fun. I like it.
Nice. Our chat room looks in rough shape here. I'm not sure what's going on.
I know. Well, there's people coming in and out. It's people on their iPhones as they're driving, I think, is what happens. And they get bounced and then they can come back, you know, as they jump cells and lose the stream. Bro, don't cross the streams.
That's right.
All right. A couple more. You want to do Brian or are we going to skip that one again?
No, let's do it.
Go.
I think it's a
go.
Hi, Dave and John. Brian said that. For years, my wife used an old iMac G5 desktop in the kitchen for email and some minor web surfing. I'd kept the machine running over the years. Oh, awesome. I love this. More as a hobby than anything else, but recently it died again and I have no desire to try and fix a machine that old. It ran OS 10 10.5.8 Leopard ? Anyway, I found out that she had been keeping her address book on the machine. There is, however, a super duper backup of the old machine as well as a Time Machine backup, both on an external drive. Question is there any way to rescue that address book data and use it in her new iPad? My iMac, Mountain Lion, won't read the old files. Any thoughts from you guys? Appreciate it.
Brian Go.
From Philly. Give it the best I can here. So, number one, thank goodness he has a backup. So, good thing you have a backup. Sounds like you've already tried to transfer whatever files are in user directory, library, application support, address book. Specifically, there's a file called address book -V22ABCDDB. So that is, last I checked, the file where Actress Book stores its contents. Even though it's called Contacts now, that's still the name of the file, at least in my systems.
Here. Okay.
So it's so it sounds like he's tried that and it didn't work. Failing that, what I would suggest, though I know he wants to retire the system here, if he can get it up and running, I'm hoping that the version of Address Book on that OS, and I do not have that version of OS running, believe it or not, but I'm hoping that Address Book, at least hopefully the Address Book in that version, has some sort of export option, because the current version of Address Book or Contacts does. And you're going to find this if you go under File and then Export. And at least the last two versions that I've seen here is that they will show two options there. One is Export vCard, which is pretty much a standard for address data. And then the other is Export Contacts Archive, which is more specific to the Apple ecosystem.
Yep.
So that's really the best I can do there. Short of bringing in that DB file, is try to, again, you know, give it one last startup and try to do an export and see if you can pull that data in. I would bet on the vCard format being probably, you may lose something, but I'd say I hope that does it for him.
Yeah, there's an addressbook.data file that lives out there too. It used to be, like, way back, it stored everything as a vCard all the time. And then that went away when they put it inside a database, presumably because it's much faster to access. But that leaves us with this situation here. It probably is a SQLite, S-Q-L-I-T-E, database, because that tends to be what is used for core data. So you might be able to mess with that. I think your solution of, you know, trying to get it to boot one last time, or finding a machine that's running that and just putting that entire folder, that, you know, that home library application support address book, put that whole folder in, start up address book, and export everything out. That's what I got. Right?
Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, good. I know Pilot Pete's got to go shortly here, because he's actually got to go fly. He's been sitting here this whole time in his flight uniform, John.
He told me it was a formal show. I wore my tie.
You know? He's got his stripes on and everything.
You'll actually change into scrubs once you get on the plane, won't you?
Only for long distance.
Okay.
Yeah, I only do that for the long haul.
That makes sense.
Going out to Honolulu or something like that. Then, yeah.
Yeah. But in the airport, you got to look respectable. That's right.
If you don't look good.
That's right. Yeah, you're not getting through security. That's right.
Yeah, long haul international, because there's no passengers. We change into, you know, some guys wear
sweatpants,
yeah, scrubs, that kind of stuff. Yeah. I wear scrubs.
Scrubs probably because they're easy to pack. They're light.
Lightweight, easy to pack, comfortable.
Yeah. Cool.
Because I think you were hinting at, you got to look good to feel good.
That's right.
That's right. Yeah, Fernando. That's right. So very quickly, I did want to tell you, because I don't know if you have seen it yet, but I went and saw the Jobs movie last night, the one with Ashton Kutcher. Have you seen it, John?
I typically wait for things to come out on disc. So
okay.
No.
So no. Okay. That's an easy answer. It's an interesting movie. If you are a fan of Apple and the whole story, I think you would enjoy seeing it. But it really, you know, it reminded me of seeing the first Harry Potter movie. I had read the book. I was really excited about seeing the movie. And then I went to the theater and I watched this series of vignettes where someone had realized on screen their representation of what these scenes that we had read about in the book looked like. That's how this movie felt to me, too. It was a lot of scenes. I'm not sure. It either needed to be longer or shorter. There was just enough information in there to confuse the heck out of someone that did not know the whole arc. But it was cool to see a lot of this stuff realized, like meetings at the Homebrew Computer Club and, you know, the first West Coast Computer Fair where they were, and even the Jobs family garage in Palo Alto where they, you know, started pulling this stuff together. That was good. You see Steve Jobs Street in Palo Alto now, where he, you know, he did a walk with Gil Emilio. So a lot of this stuff was cool. And Ashton Kutcher did a fantastic job as Steve Jobs. I mean, off the charts. Good. It's so good that there were moments like where you'd see a, you know, see him from the back or from the side or whatever. You weren't actually seeing his face. And you, if somebody said, oh, by the way, here, that's actually Steve Jobs. They just had some B-roll footage. They just showed you'd say, oh, OK, that's great, because, of course, it looks just like him. He really he grokked the whole character. But it needed more editing. It was weird. There was one scene that Lisa asked me about. My wife asked me about afterwards, where they just suddenly jumped to Jobs being at home in his house with his widow, now Lorene, but his first daughter was there in the house with him, which did happen. He did reconcile with her, and she lived with them for a period of time. But they didn't talk about any of that. They didn't talk about that he had gotten married. They didn't talk about how he had reconciled with her. And so my wife was like totally confused. She's like, was Lorene Lisa Brennan's mom? I didn't think so, but this was confusing. And so, but it was good. And if you're a fan of this, you know, and if you've listened this far to this particular episode, I'm pretty sure you are, go and see it, you know, in the theater or when it comes out on DVD. But yeah, don't expect brilliance unless they re-edit before the DVD comes out. Although you will see brilliance in Kutcher's performance. Josh Gad as Steve Wozniak. I knew going in that they were not trying to accurately portray Woz. They were more using him as a Jiminy Cricket. Yeah. You know, they were playing Steve Jobs. He was playing Steve Jobs' conscience more than he was playing Woz. I mean, he played the character of Woz, and they had him in the right places at mostly the right times. But as far as the movie was concerned, he was more, you know, Steve's conscience, Jobs's conscience.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But did it kind of get across? I mean, to me, if you had to kind of encapsulate Steve, it was a guy who personally was kind of a jackass, but he was able to motivate people to make awesome products, and he had good design sense.
That's exactly what they communicated. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. 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 No, they.
Okay.
They,
I know there's more to it.
Right.
And actually, we talked about this on yesterday's Mac Roundtable, but there's still a book that I think is one of the better books. And although it's dated, called The Journey is the Reward. And it's talking about the early days of Jobs and, you know, and some of the terrible things that he did to.
Well, that, a lot of that stuff was rehashed.
Even more, Woz.
More accurately in his bio, though.
Right, right.
You know, okay, that journey.
I'll have to read.
You got to read the bio. Yeah, you'll see. The Journey is the Reward. Was good at the time, but I think it's past its time now, and it's out of date. And there's
well, yeah, no, I agree.
Because new information has come out, you know, that sort
well,
of
it didn't cover
that.
His resurgence,
but yes, it also was not factually correct about everything that it aimed to be factually correct about, only because nobody had really spoken. I mean, Jobs hadn't spoken until you know, this book with Walter Isaacson. So. Yeah, no, it's good. It was good. I liked it. You know, like I said, it was good to see. I'm curious to see what Aaron Sorkin does with this Sony Pictures movie. I'm sure the story will be better because of everyone that's involved. However, if they do not get someone to portray Jobs at least as good as Kutcher did, that movie will be seen as a failure because that part they totally got here with this, in my opinion. So. But it was, you know, it was good. It was fun. Good movie. You know, the one thing I want to say, though, and I know Pete's got to go here, but we've got all these movies, and I get that this movie was a movie about Steve Jobs. But for those of us that lived kind of, you know, as kids at the time when all of this was happening, and I'm speaking about you and me, John.
Us.
That's us. Right. You know, Jobs was not seen as the hero. At least not for me, and I don't think for you either. It was Woz. I mean, you know, when they released the Apple IIGS.
Well, it's the engineer.
He was the engineer.
Woz to me was the engineering hero. To me, if anything,
yeah.
At least in the early days, Jobs was the marketing hero.
But he wasn't. I wouldn't even have used the term hero. I mean, he was just this.
Well, no, but he was the marketing part of Apple, at least early on.
Right.
And then I think he evolved maybe into more the designer.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Right, right. That's right.
He influenced the design and the whole Apple ecosystem. He kind of helped shape that from like the battle days of like Emilio and all that, where you had 500 different models of...
I think he helped shape it initially, too. It just wasn't all that obvious to those of us that were geeks at the time. It really was, and Apple knew this, right? I mean, you didn't get an Apple IIgs with Jobs' signature on the front. You got the Woz edition. There was no Jobs edition, you know. So it's interesting that that story seems to have been lost a little bit. And it'd be interesting if it comes back around, you know, as time marches on. I'm not convinced it will, but you know, it's something. So with that, I think it's time. Peter, are you going to duck out, or are you going to make it through the end of the show?
No, I'm going to blast as soon as you're out. I'll blast.
Okay, all right. So you can contact us. We've already said the addresses once when we spoke about mail, but we will say them again. And that is, if you want to contact us, feedback@macgeekab.com is the address to send to.
It's always worth repeating, Dave, that it's feedback@macgeekab.com.
That's right. And if you are a premium member, premium@macgeekab.com is the address that you get to send stuff to. And we do make sure that one is dealt with on a accelerated schedule.
Right. Okay. Worth mentioning again here, Dave, you mentioned it here. I'm not sure how many iTunes reviews we have, but they are very valuable. They help give the show exposure. And I think we're getting there.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd love to see us get to 400 iTunes reviews in the U.S. store by the end of August. And we put that out on Twitter. I think we need about another 40.
I got to say, well, I think you saw I sent you a screenshot, Dave. I got to say I'm very humbled here. But the last time I clipped on the technology section in iTunes, did you see this one?
Yeah.
It's number 10.
Yeah. No, it's great.
So thanks to all of you. If people did not listen to the show but also comment on it, right, we wouldn't be up there. So thank you so much.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Yeah. So go check it out and leave us a review. We would very much appreciate it. It's basically the only way that we have of telling the iTunes store folks that we should be featured. Or it's the only way you and Mass have. I can email them and tell them we should be featured, but that doesn't go over quite as well, for obvious reasons. 206-666-GEEK is the address. The address you type into your phone to call us.
It's like an IP address, but it's not. And that's 4335.
Thank you, John. You can find us on Twitter. MacGeekGab is the show. John F. Braun is that guy. Pilot Pete is this guy. Dave Hamilton is me. And, of course, you can see the headlines from Mac Observer at Mac Observer on Twitter as well. One last thing,
Facebook's,
John.
Facebook.com/MacGeekGab is where you can see when the next show will be, when the show notes are posted, and some discussion among all of you.
That'll do it. Yep. We'd like to thank Michael Johnston at the We Have Communicators podcast, also of GetAppler.com. He has converted this episode and pretty much every other episode we've ever done to AAC, adding all those chapters and links for you. So I hope you appreciate that. I know you do, because when we ask you if you do, you say yes. And that's a beautiful thing. We also want to thank Cashfly, CACHEFLY.com, for all the bandwidth they provide. It's a beautiful thing. The podcast marketplace includes BB Edit from Barebone Software, Yojimbo from Barebone Software as well, Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, all from Smile, Gazelle.com, Squarespace/MGG8, I believe, and of course, Warby Parker. You can get your glasses faster with the MGG Ship coupon code. Through the Backbeat Media Podcast Network. Pete, before you fly, I have some advice for you, my friend.
All right, I'm listening.
Are you?
Here I am.